Welcome to This Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling Maury Vaude, a 1957 Supreme Court case that really stands out, especially, I think, for you law students listening in.
Mm-hmm.
We're diving into a moment where the Supreme Court actually used the Equal Protection Clause to strike down a state economic regulation. And, you know, that's just not something you see every day, so it's worth understanding, well, why it happened.
Exactly. And the whole case really hinges on a, let's say, seemingly simple scenario.
Mm-hmm.
An Illinois law designed to regulate money order sales
mm-hmm.
had this very specific exception carved out just for American Express.
Ah.
So our goal in this deep dive is to explore why this specific detail escalated all the way to a Supreme Court decision and, you know, what it reveals about the limits of what's known as the rational basis test.
Right.
It's a really fantastic illustration of how even, you know, seemingly routine economic laws can face significant legal challenges if they aren't structured very carefully.
Okay, so let's unpack this Illinois situation then. We're talking about the Community Currency Exchanges Act. What was Illinois trying to achieve with this law in the first place?
Well, the core purpose of the Illinois Act was consumer protection, specifically in the money order business. The state wanted to ensure that companies selling these financial instruments were, well, reliable and financially stable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, protecting the public from potential fraud or, say, if a company went bankrupt. Think of it as a safeguard for people using money orders.
That makes perfect sense. I mean, you definitely want some assurance when you're dealing with financial transactions. But here's where things get really interesting. American Express was completely exempt from all these rules, right? They basically got a free pass.
Precisely. Yeah, the act contained a specific provision that completely exempted American Express from all licensing and regulatory burdens.
Wow.
They didn't need to get a license. They weren't subject to those annual inspections. And they didn't have to pay any of the associated fees. They were just entirely outside the regulatory framework that applied to everyone else in the money order business.
So, okay, who are the players on the other side of this then? Who actually challenged this special treatment for American Express?
That was George Dowd and his partners.
Uh-huh.
They operated a business selling money orders under the name Bondified.
Okay, Bondified.
Yeah. Unlike American Express, they were fully subject to all the requirements of the Illinois Act. They had to go through the licensing process, undergo regular inspections, pay the fees.
Huh.
They even had to demonstrate that their services met a standard of convenience and advantage for the community.
Mm.
I mean, imagine the frustration, yeah. Right? Having to meet all these requirements while your major competitor faced none of them.
That sounds incredibly unfair. Seriously, talk about a tilted playing field. So Dowd and his partners, they decided to take legal action. How did that unfold?
Well, they filed a lawsuit arguing that this exemption for American Express directly violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment.
Okay.
To put it simply, they argued that the state was treating them unfairly compared to American Express without a legitimate reason. The case initially went to the district court, which actually dismissed their claim.
Oh.
But the Supreme Court then intervened, overturned that initial ruling, and sent the case back down to the lower court for, you know, further consideration.
Okay.
And on the second look, the district court actually agreed with Dowd and struck down the American Express exemption as unconstitutional. So naturally, the state of Illinois then appealed that decision right back up to the Supreme Court.
So when the case arrived back at the Supreme Court, what was the fundamental legal question the justices were really trying to answer?
The central legal issue was essentially this. Was Illinois' decision to exempt American Express from these money order regulations unconstitutional discrimination under the Equal Protection Clause? The state primarily argued that American Express's, you know, long-standing financial stability and reputation provided a rational basis for treating them differently. They were seen as inherently less risky.
Mm.
In contrast, Dowd and his partners argued that this exemption created an unjustified and frankly arbitrary advantage for American Express, significantly harming their ability to compete in the market.
Okay. And how did the majority of the Supreme Court justices view this? What was Justice Burton's reasoning when he wrote the majority opinion?
Well, Justice Burton, writing for the majority, concluded that the exemption did indeed fail to pass what's known as rational basis review. Now, remember, the underlying goal of the Illinois law was consumer protection.
Right, the safeguard.
Exactly. The court acknowledged that states do have the authority to create different classifications in their laws, but, and this is key, those classifications must have a rational relationship to the law's stated objective.
Okay.
In this particular instance, the majority identified two key flaws in the exemption granted to American Express.
Okay, let's hear about those critical flaws the court found. What were they?
Okay, first, the court took issue with the underlying assumption that American Express would always remain financially sound. They considered it a weak and insufficient justification for a permanent exemption from regulations specifically designed for ongoing consumer protection.
Like, you can't just assume forever.
Right. The court reasoned that even well-established companies can face financial difficulties down the line. Second, and arguably more importantly, the court strongly emphasized that the Illinois law created what they termed a closed class.
A closed class.
Yes, by explicitly naming and favoring a single company, American Express. This, they argued, was inherently problematic and economically damaging to competitors because it provided American Express with a unique competitive advantage that no other company, regardless of its financial strength, could ever achieve.
So even if Dowd's bondified money order business became, you know, just as financially secure and reputable as American Express, they'd still be burdened by all the regulations that American Express completely avoided.
That's exactly right. And this is a really central point for the court. They underscored the significant economic disadvantage faced by competitors like Dowd's business.
Yeah.
They would remain subject to all the regulatory requirements, even if they were demonstrably as, or perhaps even more, financially stable than American Express might be at some point in the future. Justice Burton used some pretty strong language characterizing this as invidious discrimination.
Invidious discrimination.
Meaning essentially a classification that is unfair, unreasonable, and lacks a substantial connection to the legitimate purpose of the law, which again was consumer protection. To paraphrase a key point from Burton's opinion, the discrimination here is the singling out of a named company, creating a closed class with economic advantages. This kind of explicit favoritism really raised serious concerns for the court.
That sounds like a pretty definitive ruling against the state's exemption, though. But as is often the case with these big Supreme Court decisions, there were dissenting opinions, right? What were Justices Black and Frankfurter arguing?
Absolutely. Yeah, there were significant dissents from Justices Black and Frankfurter who had different reasons for disagreeing with the majority. Justice Black argued that American Express's long-standing and well-known reputation for financial solvency did constitute a perfectly rational basis for the exemption. He believed that the 14th Amendment shouldn't be interpreted in a way that lets the court second-guess the economic policy choices made by state legislatures when there appears to be, you know, a reasonable justification. His fundamental view was that the state had a legitimate reason to believe American Express posed a lower risk to consumers.
Makes sense from that perspective. And what was Justice Frankfurter's view in his dissent?
Justice Frankfurter, and he was joined by Justice Harlan, took a broader stance, cautioning against the court overstepping its role and essentially acting as what he famously called a super legislature.
Right. I've heard that term.
Yeah. He stressed that states possess wide-ranging powers to regulate commerce within their own borders, and that Illinois could have rationally distinguished American Express from other, potentially less financially sound, entities entering the money order market. He contended that unless the state's decision was clearly and demonstrably irrational, the court should really exercise judicial restraint and defer to the judgment of the elected state lawmakers. So you really see this fundamental tension in the case, right? Between the court's role in ensuring equal protection and its respect for the legislative prerogative in making economic policy decisions.
Okay, so Morey v. Dowd strikes down this Illinois law. What's the broader significance of this case? What's its legacy, especially when we think about that rational basis test that, you know, law students spend so much time learning about?
Well, Morey v. Dowd is significant because it really seemed to establish a more rigorous application of the rational basis review, at least in the context of economic regulations that singled out specific companies for preferential treatment. The court's analysis suggested a closer look at, sort of, three key questions. First, is the classification genuinely and directly tied to the stated goal of the statute? Second, does the classification reflect real and relevant differences between the entities being treated differently? And third, does the law create an arbitrary and unfair closed class that provides an undue benefit to one party at the expense of its competitors?
Right, that closed class idea again.
Exactly. At the time, Morey appeared to represent a high point in the court's willingness to use the Equal Protection Clause to carefully scrutinize state economic laws. It kind of signaled that even under the typically lenient rational basis test, there were limits to how states could differentiate between economic actors.
But you mentioned earlier that this stricter approach might have been somewhat short-lived, with the city of New Orleans v. Duke's case in 1976.
Yes, that's a really crucial point to understand the long-term impact, or lack thereof, of Morey. In the Duke's case, the court considered a New Orleans ordinance that exempted certain long-established pushcart vendors in the French Quarter from a new ban on such sales, while newer vendors were prohibited.
Ah, a grandfather clause.
Exactly, a grandfather clause. And in Duke's, the court actually upheld this, indicating a definite move back towards greater deference to state legislatures in matters of economic regulation.
So less scrutiny.
Less scrutiny, exactly. While the Duke's court didn't explicitly overrule Morey, it significantly narrowed the scope of its stricter scrutiny approach. Essentially, Morey now stands as a somewhat unusual case, an outlier almost, where economic legislation was struck down under rational basis review with a level of scrutiny that is just less common in modern Supreme Court jurisprudence.
So for our listeners, particularly those, you know, maybe studying for exams right now, what's the crucial takeaway here? Why should they pay close attention to this 1957 case?
Right, for you law students, Moore v. Dowd serves as a vital reminder that even under the seemingly forgiving rational basis review, laws that arbitrarily favor specific entities without a genuine factual connection to the law's legitimate purpose can be deemed unconstitutional.
Okay.
However, it's equally important to recognize that in the years following Morey, particularly after that Duke's decision, successfully challenging economic regulations on equal protection grounds has become considerably more challenging.
It's a higher bar now.
It's a much higher bar. The key analytical question to consistently ask in these types of cases is, does the classification truly advance the legitimate objective of the law, or is it, as you aptly described it earlier, host speaker, merely cronyism dressed as policy?
Hmm.
While contemporary courts are less inclined to be as interventionist as the Morey court was, that concept of a closed class remains a significant indicator of potential arbitrariness and a potential vulnerability for a law facing an equal protection challenge.
So it's still relevant, even if less frequently successful.
It's exactly. It highlights the enduring tension between the judiciary's oversight role and the legislature's authority to make economic policy. And just to be absolutely crystal clear, while its application has been significantly limited, Morey itself was limited, not explicitly overruled by Dukes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and one final point of clarification. The actual plaintiffs in the case were George Dowd, McDonald Carlson, and Derek Knott Bondified Systems as a legal entity itself.
Got it. Good clarification. So to kind of bring it all together, even in the area of economic regulation, where courts typically grant a lot of leeway, a lot of deference to legislatures, there are still boundaries, right? The way a law categorizes or differentiates between groups has to have some reasonable connection to what the law is actually trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
Favoring specific entities arbitrarily without a sound justification related to the law's goals can still run into trouble with the Equal Protection Clause, even if it's harder to prove now.
That's a clear and accurate summary. And it leaves us with maybe a final thought for you listeners to consider. Given the subsequent shift towards greater deference in cases like Duke's, what specific factors or circumstances might lead a modern court to still apply a somewhat more searching rational basis review when examining economic classifications that appear to create these kinds of closed classes, especially maybe in the context of today's rapidly evolving industries and regulatory landscapes?
That's a great question.
It's a question that really underscores the dynamic nature of constitutional law and its ongoing interpretation. There's always more to unpack.
Definitely something important to think about as you continue your legal studies. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us today. We really encourage everyone to keep exploring these fascinating and sometimes tricky nuances of equal protection law.
Absolutely. Thanks for tuning in.